There's a casket in my mind, and I'm standing over it. Not literally. Not yet. But I can feel the weight of it. The heaviness of something ending, something dying, something that needs to be buried before the earth opens up and swallows me whole instead. I don't remember the exact moment I realized I was already dead. That's the trick about slow decay. You don't feel it happening. One day you're full of fire, and the next you're ash pretending to still burn. You keep moving through the motions, smiling at the right times, showing up to the life you built, but somewhere deep in the marrow of your being, you know. You know you're a ghost, haunting your own existence. The old me died somewhere, between the last promise I broke to myself, and the morning I woke up and couldn't remember why I used to care. Marcus Aurelius wrote, "You could leave life right now. Let that determine what you do and say and think." But I didn't leave. I stayed. And that's almost worse, staying in a life you've already abandoned, dragging your corpse through days that blur into weeks, that collapse into years. I stayed, but I stopped living. I chose the casket before death chose me. This is the funeral I never held. Stand here with me for a moment. Look at what's in that casket. It's not a body. It's a version of you. The one who thought comfort was the destination. The one who believed that success meant approval, that happiness meant avoiding pain, that strength meant never breaking down. The one who built a life out of other people's blueprints and called it yours. That version is dead. It has to be. Because here's what nobody tells you about death. It's not always tragic. Sometimes it's mercy. Sometimes the most loving thing you can do for yourself is let something die. A belief, a habit, an identity that's strangling the person you're becoming. I spent a decade running from this funeral. I numbed it with distractions, screens that glowed promises of connection while isolating me further, ambitions that looked like progress but kept me running in circles, relationships where I performed instead of existed. I was terrified of the silence that comes after you stop pretending. Terrified of standing in the wreckage and admitting that I built this, that I chose this, that every cage I complained about I constructed bar by bar. The Stoics understood something we've forgotten in our comfort-obsessed age. Death is not the enemy. Delusion is. Pretending you have infinite time is. Living as if tomorrow is guaranteed while today rots in your hands. That's the real tragedy. I remember the night it broke through. I was sitting in my apartment, lights off, city humming outside my window, all those lives moving forward while mine stood still. I caught my reflection in the black screen of my television. For just a second, I didn't recognize myself. Not the face, the eyes. They looked hollow. Hungry for something they'd forgotten how to name. And I thought, when did I become this? Not all at once, that's for sure. Slowly, imperceptibly, like erosion, like rust. You make one compromise, then another, and each one feels small, manageable, justified. You're just being realistic, just being practical, just being adult. But compromises compound. And eventually you look up and realize you're not even a shell of who you were. You're a forgery. The person in that casket is the forgery. I built them carefully, meticulously. I listened when the world said, "Be reasonable," and I learned to make myself smaller. I heard, "Follow the path," and I stopped asking where it led. I was told, "This is just how life is." And I stopped believing it could be different. Comfort became my anesthetic. Routine became my prison. safety became the thing that was slowly killing me. There's a question that keeps circling back, relentless as a vulture. What would I do if I knew I was dying? Not someday dying, not abstractly, philosophically dying, dying soon, dying now. Would I keep scrolling, keep postponing, keep pretending that the life I'm tolerating is the life I'm meant to live? Would I keep investing in futures that don't excite me, relationships that drain me, versions of success that make me feel empty? Of course not. But here's the knife twist. I am dying. You are too. Right now. This moment is one you'll never get back. And the version of you reading these words is already becoming past tense. Time doesn't pause for your readiness. Death doesn't wait for your permission. The question isn't whether you'll die. It's whether you'll live first. This funeral, the one I'm holding now, the one you might need to hold too, isn't morbid. It's honest. It's the kind of honesty that burns away pretense and leaves only truth. Sometimes you have to name what's dead before you can bury it. Sometimes you have to stop pretending the old ways are still working before you can build something new. I'm not here to motivate you. Motivation is cheap fuel. It burns hot and fast and leaves you cold when it's gone. I'm here to witness with you, to stand at this casket and acknowledge what needs to die, to stop running from the grief of letting go and instead walk straight into it, through it, until we reach the other side. Because on the other side of this funeral is freedom. Not the freedom of having everything you want, the freedom of knowing what you actually need, not the freedom of endless options, the freedom of clear purpose, not the freedom of avoiding pain, the freedom of meeting it head on and discovering it can't destroy you. The old you believed comfort would save you, but comfort is just a slow drowning where you forget you're underwater. The old you believed validation would complete you, but you spent so much time becoming what others approved of that you forgot what you actually are. The old you believed tomorrow would be different, but tomorrow is built from today, and today you're still making the same choices that led you here. So we burn it, all of it, not with hatred, with clarity, not with regret, with resolve. We burn the old you the way a forest fire clears dead wood to make space for new growth. We burn it because transformation isn't addition, it's subtraction. It's stripping away everything false until only truth remains. Marcus Aurelius kept a reminder close. It is not death that a man should fear, but never beginning to live. You've been dying wrong. We both have. We've been dying slowly, unconsciously, without purpose. We've been letting our potential wither while we distract ourselves with comfort. This is where it ends. This is where we stop dying accidentally and start living deliberately. This is the funeral. The ashes are already prepared. The old you is already gone. We're just finally admitting it. And in that admission, in that acceptance, in that willingness to let go of who we thought we had to be, something new becomes possible. The fire is waiting. Your rebirth is on the other side of this ending. Are you ready to burn? I used to think comfort was the goal. Work hard, save money, build a life where I wouldn't have to struggle anymore, where I could exhale, where I could finally relax into the ease I'd earned. That was the dream, wasn't it? The finish line we're all racing toward, the place where things get easier. I reached it, and it nearly destroyed me. Here's what nobody warns you about comfort. It's a predator disguised as a reward. It arrives with soft promises and warm embraces, whispering that you've worked hard enough, that you deserve rest, that you can finally stop pushing and just be. And it feels good. God, it feels good. Like lowering yourself into a hot bath after a brutal day. Like the world finally giving you permission to stop striving. But comfort doesn't stop at rest. It metastasizes into stagnation. It sedates your hunger. It numbs the part of you that dreams and dares and demands more from this one precious life. Comfort tells you that pain is the enemy, that struggle is failure, that if you're uncomfortable, you must be doing something wrong. Comfort is a beautiful liar. I spent years in its embrace. I built routines that required nothing from me. I surrounded myself with easy choices. I optimized my life for minimal friction, maximum predictability, zero risk. I told myself this was wisdom. This was maturity. This was what it meant to have my life together. I was rotting from the inside out. Epictetus said, "It is not things that disturb us, but our judgments about them." I judged discomfort as the enemy. I decided that any feeling of strain, of challenge, of resistance meant I was off course. So I course-corrected constantly, away from difficulty, toward ease, away from growth, toward safety. I built a life that asked nothing of me and was surprised when I felt like nothing. The addiction to comfort is more insidious than any drug because it's socially acceptable, celebrated even. Treat yourself. You deserve it. Take it easy. We've built an entire culture around avoiding discomfort, medicating every moment of unease with entertainment, food, substances, scrolling, shopping, anything to not feel the friction of being alive. But friction is where we're forged. I remember a winter morning 3 years ago. My alarm went off for a run. It was dark, cold, raining. The kind of morning that makes your warm bed feel like salvation. And I thought, I could skip today, just once, just this morning. I'm tired. I'll go tomorrow. I didn't go tomorrow either, or the next day, or the week after that. That's how it starts. One small surrender, one reasonable compromise, one moment where comfort wins, and you tell yourself it doesn't matter. It's just once. You'll get back to it. But you don't realize you're not just skipping a run. You're teaching yourself that discomfort is optional. You're training your brain that whenever things get hard, retreat is acceptable. The problem with comfortable lives is that they make comfortable people. And comfortable people don't change the world. They don't change themselves. They don't create anything worth creating or become anyone worth becoming. They just maintain. They coast. They optimize for ease until their lives become so frictionless they slip right through their own fingers. I see it everywhere now. This pandemic of comfort. People living below their potential, not because they lack ability, but because they lack discomfort. They've engineered pain out of their existence and wonder why they feel so numb. They've built lives where nothing is at stake and wonder why nothing feels meaningful. Comfort kills meaning. It kills growth. It kills the parts of you that need challenge to stay alive. There's a reason every wisdom tradition throughout history includes some element of deliberate hardship. Fasting, cold exposure, simplicity, physical challenge. It's not about suffering for suffering's sake. It's about remembering who you are when the cushions are stripped away. It's about discovering that you're capable of so much more than your comfort zone convinced you of. The Stoics practiced voluntary discomfort religiously. Marcus Aurelius, Emperor of Rome, slept on the floor. Seneca, one of the richest men in Rome, regularly lived like a pauper to remember that loss wouldn't destroy him. They understood something we've forgotten. Comfort is training you for fragility. Every time you choose ease over effort, you're making yourself weaker, more dependent, more afraid of the very challenges that would make you stronger. I spent a decade in that trap, a decade of choosing the easy path, the comfortable choice, the frictionless option, a decade of telling myself tomorrow would be different, while today I chose the same soft surrender. And every time I chose comfort, I lost a little more self-respect. Because deep down, beneath all the rationalizations, I knew. I knew I was capable of more. I knew I was settling. I knew I was betraying the person I could become for the temporary ease of the person I was. That knowledge eats at you, slowly at first, then faster. It's the voice you try to drown out with Netflix binges and social media scrolls. It's the feeling you try to numb with whatever your drug of choice is. It's the truth you keep avoiding that eventually corners you in a dark room at 3 a.m. when you can't sleep because you can't stop thinking about all the time you've wasted. Here's the paradox. Avoiding discomfort doesn't make you comfortable. It makes you anxious because you're constantly running from the thing you need most. The challenge that would prove to yourself that you're still alive, still capable, still becoming. True comfort, real peace, comes from the other side of discomfort. It comes from doing the hard thing and discovering you can handle it, from facing the pain and realizing it didn't break you, from choosing effort over ease and watching yourself become someone you respect. The comfort zone isn't a place of rest. It's a place of slow death. I think about the person I was 3 years ago. Before the run I didn't take, before the thousand other small surrenders that followed, that person had dreams, plans, a fire that hadn't been extinguished yet. They believed they could do hard things. Then I chose comfort, again and again, until I became someone who couldn't do hard things, someone who needed everything to be easy, someone who folded at the first sign of resistance. Comfort didn't free me, it imprisoned me. And the cruelest part, I locked myself in. I forged my own chains out of soft blankets and easy choices. I built my own cage out of routines that required nothing from me. I became my own jailer, and I called it self-care. But self-care isn't about making life easier. It's about making yourself stronger, strong enough to handle difficulty, strong enough to pursue meaning even when it's hard. Strong enough to become the person you're meant to be, even if that person makes your current self uncomfortable. The enemy isn't out there. It's in here, in the part of me that still reaches for easy over meaningful, for comfortable over growth, for numb over alive. This chapter is closing, the one where comfort was the goal. The one where I organized my entire existence around avoiding discomfort. The one where I confused ease with happiness and wondered why I felt so empty. Comfort was never the answer. It was the question I was too afraid to ask. What am I capable of when I stop hiding? The old me chose the warm bed, the easy path, the soft surrender. Chose it so many times it became who I was, someone who couldn't be trusted to do hard things, even for myself. That person is in the casket now. Next to them is the belief that comfort equals success, that ease equals wisdom, that avoiding pain equals living well. We're burning that too. Because on the other side of comfort is the person you were meant to become. And they're not soft. They're not safe. They're not easy to be around or easy to live with. They're forged in fire, built through friction, earned through effort. And they're waiting for you to choose them over the temporary ease of who you are right now. Stand in front of a mirror. Not to fix your hair or check your outfit. Not to rehearse a smile or practice confidence. Stand there and look. Really look. At the eyes staring back. At the person behind them. Can you hold your own gaze? I couldn't. For years, I couldn't. Every time I caught my reflection unexpectedly, in a window, a phone screen, a bathroom mirror in harsh lighting, I looked away, not consciously, not with thought, but something in me recoiled. Something in me knew that if I looked too long, I'd have to see. And seeing would require acknowledging, and acknowledging would demand change. So I didn't look. I glanced. I passed by. I kept moving, kept busy, kept my eyes on anything but the truth of what I'd become. The Stoics were obsessed with self-examination, not the self-help kind, not the gentle, be-kind-to-yourself kind, the brutal kind, the kind that strips away every excuse and forces you to name exactly what you've been avoiding. If you seek tranquility, Marcus Aurelius wrote, do less, or do what's essential. But first, you have to know what's essential, and to know what's essential, you have to clear away what's false. And to clear away what's false, you have to admit you've been lying. I've been lying for so long, I forgot what truth felt like. Small lies at first. Telling myself I was happy when I was numb. Telling myself I was busy when I was avoiding. Telling myself I'd change tomorrow when I had no intention of changing today. Little betrayals, little compromises, little moments where I chose the comfortable delusion over the uncomfortable truth. But lies compound. They build on each other, layer after layer, until you're living in a house of cards and calling it a fortress. Until you're so invested in the illusion that admitting the truth feels like admitting your entire life has been a waste. Maybe it has been, parts of it anyway. That's what the mirror test reveals, the parts you've been wasting, the years you've been coasting, the potential you've been burying, the person you've been betraying with every choice that prioritizes comfort over becoming. I made a list once, a real one, honest. The kind of list you write in the dark when you can't sleep and the truth won't let you rest anymore. Things I've been lying about. It was longer than I expected, longer than I wanted, longer than I could face all at once. I lied about my ambitions. I told people I was content, that I'd found my path, that I was right where I wanted to be. The truth? I was terrified to want more, terrified of trying and failing, so I pretended not to want. I pretended small dreams were wisdom and settling was maturity. I lied about my relationships. I stayed in ones that felt safe rather than alive. I performed intimacy instead of risking it. I kept people at arm's length and called it boundaries. I abandoned friendships that challenged me and kept ones that let me hide. I lied about my health. I told myself I'd start tomorrow, that I was too busy, too tired, too stressed, that I'd earned the right to let myself go. But the truth was simpler and uglier. I'd stopped caring. I checked out of my own body like a hotel room I planned to trash and leave behind. I lied about my habits. I called scrolling relaxing. I called numbing coping. I called avoiding protecting my peace. I dressed up every escape in therapeutic language so I wouldn't have to admit I was running. I lied about my potential. I told myself I'd peaked, that this was it, that who I am now is who I'll always be. I made peace with mediocrity and called it self-acceptance. I stopped pushing and called it wisdom. But the biggest lie, the one that enabled all the others, was this. I told myself it didn't matter, that one more day of comfort wouldn't make a difference, that one more compromise wouldn't cost me anything, that I had time, that I could always change later, that the gap between who I am and who I could be wasn't growing wider with every passing year. That lie almost killed me. Not literally, slowly, the way a river kills stone, erosion so gradual you don't notice until there's nothing left. Epictetus said, "It is not things that disturb us, but our judgments about them." My judgment about myself had become a protection racket. I judged myself gently to avoid the pain of seeing clearly. I gave myself participation trophies for showing up to my own life. I graded on a curve so steep that any effort, no matter how minimal, counted as progress. I became my own enabler, my own worst enemy disguised as my own best friend. The mirror test forces you to stop, to actually look, to ask questions you've been avoiding. Who have I become? Is this who I wanted to be? Am I proud of the choices I've made? If someone I admired could see inside my life, really see it, not the curated version I show the world, would they be impressed or disappointed? If my younger self, the one who had dreams, who believed in something, who thought they were destined for more, could see me now, what would they think? Would they recognize me? Would they be proud? Or would they feel betrayed? I know my answer. It's not pretty. My younger self would look at who I've become and feel robbed. Robbed of the life they thought they'd build. Robbed of the person they thought they'd become. They'd see all the compromises, all the surrenders, all the times I chose safety over possibility. And they'd ask, "When did you give up?" I don't have a good answer, because I didn't give up all at once. I gave up slowly, incrementally, one compromise at a time, one rationalization at a time, one "I'll start tomorrow" at a time. Until tomorrow never came, and I became someone who doesn't start things anymore, who doesn't risk things anymore, who doesn't believe things are possible anymore. That realization, that moment of truly seeing what you've become and how far it is from what you intended, is excruciating. It's the kind of pain you can't numb, the kind of truth you can't unsee, but it's also necessary. Because you can't rebuild until you acknowledge what broke. You can't heal until you admit the wound. You can't change until you face exactly what needs changing. The mirror test isn't punishment. It's diagnosis. I stand in front of it now, metaphorically, literally, spiritually. I look at every lie I've told myself, every compromise I've rationalized, every dream I've abandoned, every standard I've lowered. I name them, one by one. This is what the Stoics meant by self-examination. Not the gentle kind, the surgical kind. The kind that cuts out what's dead so what's alive can grow. Shame rises. Of course it does. Shame for all the time wasted, all the potential squandered, all the ways I betrayed myself while pretending I was being realistic. But beneath the shame, something else stirs. something harder, cleaner, sharper. Resolve. Because now I know, now I see, now I can't unknow or unsee. The illusion is shattered. The comfortable lies are exposed. The gap between who I am and who I could be is visible in stark, undeniable clarity. And that gap is either going to grow wider or start closing. There's no standing still anymore. No more pretending. No more comfortable delusion. The mirror has shown me the truth. Now comes the harder part. Living like I believe it. I used to think freedom meant having everything I wanted. Now I know freedom means needing nothing. There's a scene playing out in my mind, vivid as memory, though I haven't lived it yet. I'm standing in front of a fire. Not a campfire, not a hearth, a real fire. A burning that consumes. In my hands, I'm holding the things I thought defined me. A phone filled with notifications that made me feel important. Connections that made me feel less alone. Validation that made me feel real. Diplomas and certificates that told the world I was credentialed, qualified, worthy of respect. Photos of who I used to be, who I pretended to be, who I wanted people to think I was. Clothes that cost too much, bought to impress people I didn't even like. Objects that I convinced myself I needed, that would make me happy, that would finally fill whatever was empty inside. One by one, I'm feeding them to the flames. Not out of anger, not out of nihilism, out of understanding. The Stoics had a word for this. Apatheia. Not apathy, detachment. The ability to exist without being owned, to appreciate without needing, to engage without being enslaved. Seneca wrote, "Wealth consists not in having great possessions, but in having few wants." But we've built an entire civilization on the opposite premise. We're taught that accumulation equals success, that more means better, that attachment equals love, possession equals security, status equals worth. We're taught to define ourselves by what we have, what we own, what we've achieved, what others think of us. And slowly, imperceptibly, those things start to own us back. I didn't notice when it happened, when my possessions became my prison, when my achievements became my identity, when my reputation became more important than my character, when validation from strangers became more real than my own self-knowing. It happened the way slavery always happens, willingly at first, one chain at a time, each one disguised as something valuable. I remember buying my first nice watch, not expensive by some standards, but more than I'd ever spent on something purely for status. I told myself it was an investment, a milestone, a reward for hard work. But really, I wanted people to notice. I wanted to wear proof that I'd made it. For a while, it worked. People did notice. Compliments came. I felt seen, validated, important. Then the watch stopped mattering. The novelty wore off, the validation faded. So I needed something else, something more, something new. The cycle began. More clothes, better car, bigger apartment, shinier achievements, carefully curated social media, each acquisition a temporary hit of dopamine, followed by the inevitable crash, followed by the hunt for the next fix. I was an addict, not to substances, to things, to status, to validation, to the external markers that I'd convinced myself made me real. Marcus Aurelius, Emperor of Rome, literally the most powerful man in the world, reminded himself daily, "Very little is needed to make a happy life. It is all within yourself, in your way of thinking." He had everything. He needed nothing. I had very little. I needed everything. That's the trap of attachment. It doesn't matter what you have. If you need it, it owns you. If your peace depends on keeping it, you're a slave to it. If your identity is built on it, you're as fragile as the thing itself. I built my identity on sand, on things that could be taken, on opinions that could change, on achievements that could fade, on a body that would age, on possessions that would break, on status that would shift. And I lived in constant, low-grade terror that it would all disappear, because it will. It all will. That's the other thing the Stoics understood that we keep forgetting. Impermanence is the only permanence. Everything we attach to is already in the process of being lost. The job you think defines you, it will end. The relationship you think completes you, it will change or end. The body you're so proud of or so ashamed of, it's aging right now. The possessions you've accumulated, they're degrading, depreciating, destined for a landfill or an estate sale. Even your achievements, the things you worked hardest for, the accomplishments you're most proud of, they fade. Today's breakthrough is tomorrow's forgotten news. Today's success is next year's remember when. Nothing lasts, nothing stays. Nothing is secure, except you. Not the you defined by things. Not the you validated by others. Not the you constructed from achievements and possessions and status. The you underneath all that. The consciousness that witnesses. The awareness that remains even when everything else changes. That's what the fire reveals. That's what burning attachment exposes. When you strip away everything external, the props, the costumes, the validation, the things, what remains? Either a solid core or a terrifying emptiness. I found emptiness. Years ago, when I first started this process, when I first began questioning what I was attached to, I tried to imagine losing everything. Job, possessions, relationships, status, all of it. And I felt nothing. No, worse than nothing. I felt like I would disappear. Like without those external markers, there would be no me at all. I'd constructed my entire sense of self around things outside myself. And without them, I had no idea who I was. That's when I knew. I wasn't free. I was dependent, addicted, owned by everything I thought I owned. The burning had to begin, not literally destroying things, though sometimes that helps. Burning attachment means severing the cord between your peace and external circumstances. It means practicing the loss before the loss happens. It means remembering daily that you came into this world with nothing, and you'll leave with nothing. And everything in between is borrowed time with borrowed things. Epictetus taught his students to practice this. Hold nothing too tightly. Look at your most precious possession and remind yourself, tomorrow this could be gone. Look at your greatest achievement and remember, this too is temporary. Look at the person you love most and acknowledge, one day, one of us will lose the other. It sounds morbid. It's actually liberating. Because when you stop depending on things staying the same, you stop living in fear of change. When you stop building your identity on external markers, you stop being fragile. When you practice detachment, you don't love less. You love more freely, more fully, without the desperation of clinging. I'm learning this slowly, painfully, imperfectly. I'm learning to hold my achievements lightly, proud of them, but not defined by them. I'm learning to appreciate possessions without needing them. Grateful when they're here. Undestroyed when they're gone. I'm learning to value relationships without depending on them. Loving fully while knowing nothing is permanent. I'm learning to build my sense of self from within rather than from external validation. Knowing who I am regardless of who sees it. This is the fire that transforms, not the destruction of caring, the destruction of clinging, not the end of ambition, the end of attachment to outcomes, not the rejection of the world, the rejection of being owned by it. In that bonfire of attachment, something strange happens. As you burn through what you thought you needed, you discover what you actually are. As you release what you thought defined you, you find what's actually essential. Stripped of the external, you find the internal. Freed from dependence, you find strength. Released from ownership, you find freedom. The old me was buried under possessions, achievements, validations, attachments. The old me thought all of that was me. It wasn't. It was just weight, just chains I'd forged myself and called them treasures. The fire is burning them now. The old identity, constructed from external things, is turning to ash. And beneath it, something simpler, stronger, more essential is being revealed. Not the person others told me to be, not the person I thought I needed to be, just me, raw, unadorned, undefined by anything except the choices I make and the character I build. That person doesn't need a phone to feel connected, doesn't need diplomas to feel worthy, doesn't need validation to feel real, doesn't need possessions to feel secure. That person is free. The burning continues. There's more to release. More attachments to sever, more dependencies to acknowledge and destroy. But for the first time, I'm not afraid of the fire. I'm walking into it. The hardest thing I've ever done is sit still. Not move, not scroll, not produce, not consume, not distract. Just exist. In silence with myself. Turns out, I've been running from that for years. We all have. We've built a civilization of noise. Constant input. Constant stimulation. Constant distraction from the one thing we're terrified to face. Our own minds. Think about it. When's the last time you were truly alone with your thoughts? Not driving with the radio off while you mentally plan your day. Not lying in bed scrolling before sleep. Actually alone. Actually present. Actually still. For most of us, the answer is never. Or so long ago, we can't remember. We wake up and immediately grab our phones. We move through our days plugged into podcasts, music, audiobooks, notifications. We fill every gap, every pause, every moment of potential silence with something external. We've become addicted to input, dependent on distraction, terrified of the space between thoughts. Because in that space, truths emerge, truths we've been running from. The Stoics knew this. They didn't just practice philosophy, they practiced silence, solitude, withdrawal from the noise of the world to hear the signal of their own minds. Marcus Aurelius. Nowhere can man find a quieter or more untroubled retreat than in his own soul. But you have to actually go there. You have to stop running. You have to sit in the silence and face whatever rises. I tried this once, years ago, made it 7 minutes before I grabbed my phone. 7 minutes of sitting with myself felt unbearable. My mind raced, my body fidgeted, Anxiety crawled under my skin like insects. I needed something, anything to pull me out of my own head. That should have been my first clue. That the thing I was most afraid to face was myself. I've been avoiding silence the way an addict avoids withdrawal. Because silence is where the withdrawal happens. It's where all the noise I've been using to numb myself stops working. It's where I have to feel everything I've been avoiding. Regret, shame, fear, inadequacy, loneliness, the yawning gap between who I am and who I wanted to become. Silence doesn't let you hide from that. Silence makes you face it. So I ran. I filled my life with so much doing that I never had to risk being. I stayed busy, stayed productive, stayed distracted. I told myself this was ambition, this was success, this was what engaged living looked like. It was escape. After the funeral, after confronting comfort, after facing the mirror, after burning attachments, after all of that, I knew what came next. I had to stop running. I had to enter the silence, not as punishment, as purification. I found a place, doesn't matter where, remote enough that I couldn't hear traffic, simple enough that there was nothing to do, small enough that I couldn't avoid myself. No phone, no internet, no books, no music, no podcasts, nothing but time and silence and whatever was waiting for me inside my own head. The first day was agony. My mind screamed for input. My hands reached for the phone that wasn't there. My body paced, fidgeted, searched for something to do. Boredom crashed over me in waves, but it wasn't boredom. It was withdrawal. My brain was so used to constant stimulation that the absence of it felt like physical pain. I wanted to leave, to quit, to go back to the noise and call this experiment a failure. But I stayed, because I knew if I couldn't sit with myself for a few days, I'd never be free. I'd always be a slave to distraction, always running, always one notification away from being yanked out of my own life. The second day, something shifted. The panic started to fade. The desperate need for input began to quiet. And in the space that opened up, thoughts arose that I'd been drowning out for years. Memories I'd buried. Emotions I'd avoided. Questions I'd been too afraid to ask. Who am I when no one's watching? What do I actually want, stripped of all the shoulds and expectations? What have I been running from? Why am I so afraid of my own company? The silence answered, but not with words, with feelings, with images, with truths that couldn't be articulated but could be felt. I saw myself clearly for the first time in years. Not the performed version I showed the world, not the idealized version I showed myself, just me, flawed, afraid, pretending, running, and I saw something else. Potential, not the inflated kind, not the motivational poster kind, real potential, the person I could become if I stopped running, if I faced myself, if I built from truth instead of illusion. By the third day, the silence stopped feeling like punishment. It started feeling like medicine. My thoughts slowed, became clearer, less reactive, less chaotic. I could watch them arise and pass without being swept away by them. I could observe my emotions without being consumed by them. I started to understand what the Stoics meant about the retreat to your own soul. Not as escape from the world, as return to your center, the place where you're not performing, not reacting, not running, just existing, just being, just aware. Seneca spent years in exile, forced solitude, Most people would have seen it as punishment. He saw it as opportunity. Time to write, to think, to practice philosophy without distraction. He emerged stronger, clearer, more himself than before. "Associate with those who will make a better man of you," he wrote. "Welcome those whom you yourself can improve. The process is mutual, for men learn while they teach. But before you can do any of that, before you can connect authentically with others, you have to connect with yourself. And you can't do that in the noise." The fourth day, I stopped counting days. Time felt different in the silence. Not slow, spacious. Like each moment had room to breathe. Like I had room to breathe. I noticed things I'd been too distracted to notice before. The way light changes throughout the day. The sound of wind. The feeling of my own breathing. Small things, simple things, but they felt profound because I was actually present for them. Most of my life, I realized, I'd been somewhere else, mentally checking out, planning ahead, replaying the past, escaping into my phone, anywhere but here, anyone but me. The silence taught me to be here, to be me, to stop fragmenting my attention across a thousand inputs and gather it all into one point. Now, this moment, this breath, this choice. The old me couldn't have done this. The old me needed constant distraction to avoid constant discomfort, needed noise to drown out truth, needed busyness to avoid reflection. That version is burning away in the silence. What remains is quieter, steadier, more solid. Not because silence solved all my problems, because silence revealed what the problems actually were, and in that revelation, the path forward became clear. I don't need to be more productive. I need to be more present. I don't need more information. I need more integration. I don't need to do more. I need to be more. More honest, more courageous, more aligned with who I actually am beneath all the noise. The silence didn't give me those answers. It gave me the space to hear them. By the time I left that place, I was different, not transformed. That's too dramatic. Initiated. I'd crossed a threshold. I'd proven to myself that I could sit with myself, that my own company wasn't something to run from, that beneath all the noise I'd built my life on, there was something solid. The silence broke me open, showed me the rot, the fear, the avoidance, but it also showed me what was underneath, a core that hadn't been destroyed by years of distraction, a center that was still there, still waiting, still possible. I carry that silence with me now, not as a place I go to, as a state I return to. 5 minutes in the morning, 10 minutes at night, moments throughout the day where I disconnect from input and reconnect with center. It's not easy. My mind still reaches for distraction. My hands still grab for the phone. But I'm training a new habit, a new way of being. I'm learning to find the quiet in the chaos, the stillness in the noise, the center that holds when everything else is spinning. Epictetus said, "First say to yourself what you would be, and then do what you have to do." But you can't say to yourself what you would be if you never listen to yourself, if you're always drowning in external input, if you're always running from the one conversation that matters most, the one with your own soul. The silence is where that conversation happens. It's where the old you dies and the new you is born. It's where transformation stops being a concept and starts being a felt experience. Act one ends here, in the silence, in the space after destruction and before reconstruction. in the emptiness that terrifies but liberates, in the stillness that reveals what's actually true. The old me is gone, burned away in fire and silence and truth. The new me hasn't fully emerged yet, but they're coming. I can feel them, rising from ash, forged in absence, reborn from nothing into something real. The funeral is over. The death is complete. Now comes the hardest part, learning to live again. The silence taught me something crucial. Most of my suffering came from fighting things I couldn't change. Everything. I was fighting everything. The weather, other people's opinions, the past, time, my own thoughts, traffic, politics, the economy, outcomes I couldn't control, events I couldn't predict, reactions I couldn't command. I was exhausting myself, wrestling with the immovable, trying to control the uncontrollable, pouring energy into a void that gave nothing back. Epictetus drew a circle. Inside it, your thoughts, your choices, your actions, your character. Outside it, everything else. He said the key to tranquility, real peace, not comfortable numbness, was knowing the difference. Make the best use of what is in your power and take the rest as it happens. Simple words, revolutionary practice. I spent 30 years outside that circle, obsessing over what I couldn't control, trying to force outcomes, trying to manage other people's perceptions, trying to predict and prevent every possible negative scenario. My mind was a chaos of contingency plans for situations that might never happen. Meanwhile, the things I could control, my effort, my attitude, my discipline, my response, I neglected. I let them atrophy while I burned myself out, trying to control a world that was never mine to control. The reconstruction begins here, with clarity, with a single question that cuts through every situation. Can I control this? If yes, act. If no, release. That's it. That's the entire strategy for sanity. But it's harder than it sounds, because releasing control feels like giving up, feels like weakness, feels like letting the world happen to you instead of making things happen. That's the lie ego tells. The truth is the opposite. Trying to control what you can't is weakness. Releasing it is strength. Real power comes from focusing all your energy on your actual sphere of influence and letting everything else flow. I started small. I had to. Years of chaos don't reorganize overnight. Morning. First moment of consciousness. My mind immediately began its habitual tornado. Worries about the day, rehearsing conversations that hadn't happened, stressing about outcomes I couldn't guarantee. I caught it, stopped it, asked, can I control this right now, in this moment? Number. So I released it. Came back to what I could control. My breath. In for four. Hold for four. Out for four. Repeat. Something so simple my mind tried to dismiss it, but my body knew better. The breath steadied. The chaos quieted. The circle of control became clear. This is in my power. This breath. This moment. This choice. I started keeping a journal. Not a diary. A control audit. Two columns. Inside my control. Outside my control. The list of things outside was longer than I wanted to admit. Other people's reactions. Whether I get the job, if they text back, the traffic, the weather, the past, tomorrow, whether people like me, whether I succeed. Inside, how I respond to reactions, how I prepare for the interview, whether I reach out first, how I use the time in traffic, how I dress for the weather, what I learn from the past, what I do today, how I treat people, how much effort I give. Seeing it on paper changed something, made it real, made the circle visible. I can't control outcomes, but I can control inputs. I can't control reactions, but I can control actions. I can't control what happens, but I can control how I meet it. This is the fire of control, not the destructive kind, the refining kind. It burns away wasted energy. It focuses power. It transforms chaos into order through a simple, relentless practice. Return to the circle. Every morning, I built a ritual. Not complicated. Not long. Just deliberate. 5 minutes of breath work. Centering in the body. The moment. The only thing I truly control. 10 minutes reading Stoic philosophy. Reminding myself of the circle. Reinforcing the practice. 5 minutes setting intentions. Not outcomes, but inputs. Not, I will succeed today, but I will give my best effort today. Not, people will respect me, but I will act with integrity. 20 minutes total, but those 20 minutes created a foundation that the rest of the day could build on. When anxiety arose, and it always did, I returned to the circle. Can I control this? If not, release. If yes, act. When frustration emerged, someone cutting me off in traffic, a rude email, an unexpected setback, I returned to the circle. Can I control this? Number. Can I control my response? Yes. The Stoics called this the discipline of ascent. You don't have to accept everything that happens as good, but you do have to accept that it happened. Fighting reality is the definition of insanity. Meeting it with intentional response is the definition of power. Marcus Aurelius, facing war and plague and betrayal, wrote, "You have power over your mind, not outside events. Realize this, and you will find strength." He ruled an empire. He still couldn't control most of it. He could only control himself, his response, his character, his effort. That was enough. It had to be enough. It's all any of us have. I used to think control meant forcing outcomes, making things go my way, bending reality to my will. That's not control. That's delusion, and it leads to constant disappointment, constant frustration, constant exhaustion. Real control is simpler and harder. Managing yourself, your thoughts, your reactions, your discipline, your choices. Everything else? Weather. Let it rain. Let it storm. Let it shine. You don't control it. You don't need to. You only need to decide what you're going to do in response. This practice, this return to the circle, it's not passive. It's not resignation. It's the most active thing you can do. Because instead of dissipating energy, fighting the immovable, you concentrate it on the movable. Instead of raging at what you can't change, you focus on what you can. And slowly, day by day, practice by practice, the chaos transforms into order. Not perfect order, not some idealized state where nothing bothers you, but functional order, workable order. Order that lets you act instead of react. Order that lets you build instead of just survive. The fire of control burns away the illusion that you're supposed to manage the universe. It reveals the truth. You're only supposed to manage yourself. And that's hard enough. That's work enough. That's power enough. One breath. One choice. One moment. That's your circle. That's your power. That's where the reconstruction begins. Everything else is practice in letting go. At 5 a.m., the alarm sounds like violence. I don't want to get up. My body screams for more sleep. The bed is warm. The room is cold. Every fiber of my being votes for staying put, for choosing comfort, for 5 more minutes that will turn into 50. This is where the old me would have negotiated, rationalized, hit snooze, found reasons why today was different, why rest was more important, why I'd earned the right to ease. The new me gets up anyway, not because it feels good, because it doesn't. This is the practice Seneca prescribed 2,000 years ago. Set aside a certain number of days during which you shall be content with the scantiest fare, with coarse and rough clothing, saying to yourself, "Is this the condition that I feared?" Voluntary discomfort, deliberate hardship, choosing difficulty not because you're punished, but because you're training. Every day, I practice dying to comfort. Cold shower first thing, not because I enjoy it. I don't, still, after months. Because the shock to my system does something the warm water never could. It proves I'm stronger than my resistance. It proves I can meet discomfort and not break. It proves the voice that says I can't is a liar. 30 seconds underwater so cold it feels like knives. 30 seconds of every cell screaming to retreat. 30 seconds where my mind offers 1,000 reasons to turn the dial, to cut it short, to choose ease. I stay, I breathe, I endure, and then it's over, and I'm alive. More alive than I was before, more awake, more present, more proven. This isn't about the cold water. It's about the choosing. It's about training my mind to override my comfort-seeking instincts. It's about building calluses on my will. The Stoics understood. Comfort makes you fragile. Voluntary discomfort makes you anti-fragile. Every day, I fast until noon. Not because I'm hungry, because I'm training my body to remember it can function without constant input. Because I'm breaking the conditioning that says every discomfort needs immediate relief. Because the old me used food the way an addict uses substances, to numb, to comfort, to avoid feeling anything uncomfortable. The hunger comes, sharp at first, then dull, then almost pleasant. My body adapts, my mind strengthens. I learn, discomfort is not emergency. Hunger is not crisis. I can feel uncomfortable and still function, still think, still work, still be. This changes everything. Because most of suffering isn't the pain itself. It's the fear of pain, the anticipation, the catastrophizing, the belief that discomfort equals danger. Voluntary discomfort rewires that belief. It teaches your nervous system. You can handle this. You've handled worse. You're stronger than the sensation. Training becomes ritual, not the comfortable kind, the hard kind. Weights that feel too heavy, runs that go too long, workouts that push past the point where the body begs to stop. Not because I'm punishing myself, because I'm proving something. Every rep where my muscles scream is evidence that I'm stronger than my resistance. Every mile where my lungs burn is proof that I can push past perceived limits. The old me stopped when things got hard, called it listening to my body. But I wasn't listening. I was obeying. There's a difference. Listening means discerning between actual limits and perceived ones. Obeying means surrendering at the first sign of discomfort. This isn't about ignoring injury or being reckless. It's about learning where the actual edge is. And for most of us, it's so much further than we think. I practice silence, the daily kind. Technology off for the first hour after waking. No phone, no news, no input. Just presence, just self. Just the discomfort of being without distraction. The mind protests. It's been trained to reach for stimulation, the way lungs reach for air. The absence feels like suffocation at first. I sit with it. I watch the discomfort arise and pass. I learn. I can be bored and survive. I can be understimulated and not collapse. I don't need constant input to exist. This practice, this daily death to comfort, it accumulates. Each small hardship trains the muscle of resilience. Each chosen difficulty proves that soft living makes soft people, and I'm done being soft. Marcus Aurelius woke in palace rooms and reminded himself, at dawn, when you have trouble getting out of bed, tell yourself, I have to go to work as a human being. He could have stayed comfortable. He chose discipline instead, every day, until it became who he was. The practice isn't punishment, it's preparation. Because life will bring involuntary hardship, loss, pain, difficulty you didn't choose. The question is, will you be ready? Will you be resilient? Or will you shatter because you spent your comfortable years avoiding every small discomfort? I spent too many years shattering, falling apart at minor inconveniences, collapsing under manageable stress, breaking because I'd never practiced bending. Not anymore. Now I practice daily. Small deaths, small hardships. Small choices to meet discomfort instead of avoid it. Cold water that makes me gasp. Hunger that makes me aware. Workouts that make me doubt. Silence that makes me present. Early mornings that make me disciplined. Each one a small death of the comfort-addicted self. Each one a small birth of someone stronger. The Stoics practiced this not as asceticism, but as inoculation. They lived simply, not because they hated wealth, but because they wanted to prove loss wouldn't destroy them. They practiced hardship, not because they loved suffering, but because they knew ease makes you vulnerable. We are more often frightened than hurt, Seneca wrote, and we suffer more in imagination than in reality. Voluntary discomfort kills the imagination of suffering. It replaces fear with fact. It proves I can handle hard things. I have handled hard things. I will handle hard things. This is the forge. This is where the new self is tempered. Not in comfort, in fire. Not in ease, in resistance. Not in pleasure, in endurance. Every day is a death. Every day is a choice. Every day is training. The old me chose comfort and called it self-care. The new me chooses hardship and calls it self-respect. Because I know now, the person who can endure voluntary discomfort can endure anything. The person who chooses challenge over comfort is someone they can trust. And self-trust, that's the foundation everything else is built on. The alarm sounds tomorrow at 5 a.m. It will feel like violence again, and I will get up anyway. Identity is not discovered, it's forged. I used to wait to feel passionate, wait to find my calling, wait for purpose to reveal itself like some cosmic download. Like I'd wake up one morning and suddenly know what I was meant to do. I waited years. Nothing came. Because that's not how it works. The Stoics didn't sit around waiting for purpose. They built it deliberately, daily, through choices that compounded into character. Marcus Aurelius wrote, "Waste no more time arguing what a good man should be. Be one, be one. Not become one. Not wait to feel like one. Be one. Now, today, through action. This is The Forge, where identity is hammered out through practice, discipline, and relentless commitment to values that don't change based on mood. I started with a question: who do I want to be? Not what do I want to do? Not what do I want to have? Who do I want to be? The old me would have answered with roles, job titles, achievements, status markers, things external. Now I know better. Those things are outcomes, not identity. Identity is internal. It's the code you live by, the standards you won't compromise, the person you are when no one's watching. I wrote it down. The person I'm building, disciplined. Not someday when I feel like it. Now, in small choices, getting up when the alarm sounds, doing what I said I'd do, following through even when enthusiasm fades. Honest, especially with myself. No more comfortable lies, no more rationalizations, no more performing one person while being another. Resilient, meeting hardship without breaking, adapting without losing core, bending without compromising values. Present, here, now, in this moment, instead of somewhere else. Engaged with what is, instead of what was or what might be. Generous, not with money, with attention, with effort, with care. Showing up for people, contributing more than I take. These aren't goals, they're commitments. They're not destinations I'm traveling toward. They're ways of moving through the world starting now. The difference is everything. Goals are external. Identity is internal. Goals depend on circumstances. Identity depends on choices. Goals can be blocked. Identity can only be betrayed by you. Every day becomes practice, not practice for some future version of myself. Practice of being who I've committed to being right now. Discipline. The alarm sounds. I get up. No negotiation, no debate. The commitment was made. I honor it. Honesty. Someone asks how I am. Instead of the automatic fine, I pause, check in, tell the truth, even if it's uncomfortable. Resilience. Something goes wrong. Setback, failure, disappointment. I feel it. I don't numb it. Then I ask, what's my move? What's in my control? How do I respond? Presence. I'm with someone. My phone buzzes. I don't reach for it. This person, this moment, this conversation, this is where I am. Fully. Generosity. I have extra time, energy, knowledge. I give it. Not for credit, not for return. Because that's who I've committed to being. Each practice is a hammer strike. Each choice is heat applied to metal. Each day is the forge shaping raw material into something solid. The Stoics used the metaphor of the sword, forged through fire and impact, tempered through heating and cooling, sharpened through friction. What emerges is not what went in. It's been fundamentally transformed. You are the sword. You are also the blacksmith. Most people let circumstances forge them. Whatever life throws at them shapes who they become. They're reactive, passive. They adapt to their environment instead of creating their character. This is different. This is active. This is choosing who you become instead of letting it happen to you. Every morning, I review the commitments, not reading them, embodying them. I don't ask, How do I feel about being disciplined today? I simply be disciplined. I don't wait to feel honest. I act honestly. I don't seek motivation to be resilient. I meet difficulty and respond with resilience. Feelings follow action, not the other way around. The old me waited to feel motivated before acting. The new me acts and motivation follows. The old me let moods dictate behavior. The new me lets values dictate behavior regardless of mood. The old me was whoever circumstances made them. The new me is whoever I've committed to being. This is harder, so much harder, because moods change, energy fluctuates, circumstances shift. Staying committed to values when you don't feel like it, that's the forge. That's where character is built. Epictetus taught his students, you are not your thoughts, you are not your feelings, you are your choices, you are your character, you are what you do consistently, not what you think occasionally. So I do. Consistently. Even when, especially when, I don't feel like it. The forge doesn't care about feelings. It cares about force applied repeatedly over time. Heat, impact, repetition. That's what transforms base metal into blade. I am the metal. Discipline is the heat. Choice is the hammer. Time is the repetition. What I'm forging. Someone I can trust. Someone whose word means something. Someone who doesn't collapse when tested. Someone who shows up. Someone who follows through. Someone I'd want to be. Someone I'd want to know. Not perfect. Not flawless. But solid. Reliable. True. That's identity. Not who you hope to become. Not who you wish you were. Who you are in action, in choice, in the thousand small moments when no one's looking and nothing's at stake except your relationship with yourself. The vision is clear now. The values are set. The practices are established. What remains is the only thing that's ever mattered. Daily commitment. Daily choosing. Daily forging. One day at a time. One choice at a time. One hammer strike at a time. The sword takes shape not in a moment, but in a thousand moments of heat and force and disciplined repetition. I'm not there yet, but I'm not who I was. And that's the point. That's the progress. That's the proof that the forge is working. You don't wait for purpose to find you. You forge it through values lived, through commitments honored, through the person you choose to be today and tomorrow and every day after until choosing becomes being. This is the forge. I'm in it now. The heat is on. The hammer falls. And I'm becoming. The storm hit 3 days in. Not weather, a real storm. The kind that tests everything you've been building. Lost a major client. Financial hit. Unexpected. Disorienting. The kind of setback that used to flatten me for weeks. I felt it land. The gut punch. The surge of panic. The cascade of catastrophic thoughts. This is it. I'm ruined. All the progress wasted. Back to zero. Then something different happened. I stopped. I breathed. I asked the stoic question, what can I control about this? Not the loss itself. That was done. Not the client's decision. That was theirs. Not the past. That was fixed. What I could control. My interpretation. My response. My next move. Marcus Aurelius. Choose not to be harmed, and you won't feel harmed. Don't feel harmed, and you haven't been. This isn't positive thinking. This isn't pretending bad things are good. This is something more radical, recognizing that the event itself is neutral. What makes it good or bad, empowering or destroying, is the meaning I assign to it. The event, client left. The fact, loss of income. The interpretation, disaster, failure. Proof I'm not good enough. Beginning of the end. But that interpretation, that's optional. That's chosen, usually unconsciously, habitually, based on old patterns, but still chosen. What if I chose differently? New interpretation, feedback, signal that something needs adjusting, opportunity to find better aligned clients, test of the systems I've been building, training ground for resilience. Same event, completely different meaning, completely different emotional response, completely different next action. This is the armor of perception, not denying reality, reframing it. The Stoics didn't say bad things don't happen. They said bad things are opportunities in disguise. Every obstacle contains the seeds of growth. Every setback is a setup for something better. Every difficulty is training. The obstacle is the way, wrote Marcus Aurelius. Not around the obstacle, not despite the obstacle, through the obstacle, using it, transforming it, making it the very thing that makes you stronger. I started practicing this ruthlessly. Every inconvenience, every frustration, every setback, immediate reframe. Traffic jam, not wasted time, opportunity to practice patience, chance to listen to something meaningful, training in acceptance of what I can't control, criticism, not attack, feedback, data, chance to improve or opportunity to practice non-reactivity if the criticism is baseless, injury, not punishment, message from my body, chance to adjust training, opportunity to practice patience and healing. Rain on the day I plan to run, not ruined plans, new challenge, different practice, proof I can adapt. The mind resists this. It wants to catastrophize. It's wired for threat detection, not opportunity recognition. It sees obstacles and screams, danger, problem, threat. But that wiring served us when threats were lions and cliffs. It doesn't serve us now when threats are traffic and criticism and change. Now we need different wiring. Conscious wiring. Chosen wiring. Every negative event becomes training. Every difficulty becomes testing. Every storm becomes strengthening. Not because I'm delusional, because I'm deliberate. Epictetus tells the story of being imprisoned, tortured, leg broken. His response, this is what it means to be prepared. Not why me. Not this is terrible. Not I don't deserve this. Just this is what I trained for. This is the test. This is where practice becomes proof. That's the armor. Not that nothing hurts you, that nothing destroys your capacity to respond with dignity and strength. The client who left, that was my broken leg, my imprisonment, my test. The old me would have internalized it, spiraled, made it mean something about my worth. Spent weeks recovering, doubting, reconsidering everything. The new me felt the impact, acknowledged the difficulty, then asked, what's my move? Within hours, reached out to three other prospects, audited my systems to find what needs improving, adjusted my offering based on the feedback received, acted, not because I felt great about it, because perception created a path forward instead of a pit to fall into. This is the practice. Catch the automatic interpretation. Question it. Choose a more empowering one. Not more comfortable, more empowering. Sometimes the empowering interpretation is harder. This is feedback I need to hear, is less comfortable than they're wrong about me. But it's more empowering because it puts the power back in my circle of control. Every insult becomes a test of my equanimity. Every loss becomes training in detachment. Every failure becomes education. Every storm becomes forge work. Marcus Aurelius ruled Rome through plague, war, betrayal, and constant difficulty. He wrote in his private journal, "The impediment to action advances action. What stands in the way becomes the way." He wasn't trying to convince himself. He was reminding himself. Because this practice requires constant reinforcement. The mind defaults to catastrophe. The ego defaults to victimhood. The old patterns default to, "This is terrible. I can't handle this. This shouldn't be happening." New pattern. "This is training. I can handle this. This is exactly what should be happening to forge who I'm becoming." The armor isn't avoiding strikes. It's transforming their impact. It's meeting force with force absorption. It's taking what would break the old me and using it to strengthen the new me. Not every hit is training. Some are just pain. But even pain can be met with dignity. Even unfair suffering can be endured with grace. Even genuine tragedy can be faced without collapse. The perception you choose determines the person you become. Choose victim. Become fragile. Choose obstacle. Become stuck. Choose impossible. Become defeated. Choose training. Become strong. Choose opportunity. Become resourceful. Choose test. Become proven. Same events. Different armor. Different outcome. The storm passed. The client was gone. The income was lost. But I wasn't. I was still here. Still choosing. Still building. Still becoming. That's the armor. That's the practice. That's the power. Not control over what happens. Control over what it means. And that changes everything. I failed spectacularly, publicly. The project I'd spent months building, the one I was certain would work, the one I'd told everyone about, dead on arrival. Crickets, silence, irrelevance. The old me would have been destroyed by this, would have made it mean something about my worth, would have internalized failure as identity. I am a failure. Something different happened instead. I felt the disappointment. Sharp, real, undeniable. I'm not a monk. Failure still hurts. But underneath the feeling, something solid remained. Something that didn't collapse with the outcome, because I'd learned to separate effort from result, process from outcome, who I am from what happens. This is the final discipline. Detachment from outcome. Not from effort, from attachment to specific results. Not from trying, from needing it to work out exactly as planned. Not from caring, from making your peace dependent on circumstances you can't fully control. Epictetus. Do not seek for events to happen as you wish, but wish for events to happen as they do, and your life will go smoothly. This sounds like resignation. It's the opposite. It's freedom. Because attachment to outcome is slavery. When your peace depends on external results, you've given your power away. You've made yourself hostage to circumstances, to other people's choices, to market forces, to luck, to timing, to 1,000 variables outside your circle of control. That's not power. That's fragility disguised as ambition. I used to measure my worth by outcomes. Good results meant I was valuable. Bad results meant I was worthless. My mood swung wildly based on circumstances I couldn't fully control. I was a puppet, and outcomes pulled my strings. Every success inflated me. Every failure deflated me. I was constantly ricocheting between pride and shame, confidence and doubt, depending entirely on whether things went my way. That's exhausting. More than exhausting, it's unstable, unsustainable, untrue, because outcomes don't determine worth. Process does, effort does, character does. The choices you make, not the results you get, that's who you are. The project failed, that's a fact. But the effort I put in, the discipline I showed, the skills I built, the person I became through the process, those don't fail. Those can't be taken. Those compound regardless of outcome. This is what the Stoics meant by focusing on virtue over victory. Virtue, excellence of character, quality of effort, integrity of process, that's in your control. Victory is partially in your control at best, mostly in fate's hands at worst. So you commit to what you can control and release attachment to what you can't. I gave everything to that project. Best effort, full attention, genuine care. That's success. That's what I control. That's what makes me someone I can respect. The market didn't respond. That's not my failure. That's just a fact about timing, fit, and variables I don't control. This distinction saves everything, because if outcome equals identity, then every failure destroys you. But if process equals identity, then every genuine effort strengthens you regardless of result. I started practicing this deliberately, before any effort. I'd clarify, what's in my control? My preparation, my effort, my attitude, my response. What's outside my control? The result, other people's reactions, timing, luck, outcome. Then I'd commit fully to the first category and release attachment to the second. Not release caring, release attachment. There's a difference. Caring means showing up fully. Attachment means needing it to go a specific way. Caring is engagement. Attachment is grasping. Caring makes you powerful. Attachment makes you fragile. I care about my work. I'm not attached to specific outcomes. I care about my relationships. I'm not attached to specific responses. I care about my health. I'm not attached to specific timelines. This isn't lowering standards, it's raising them, because now the standard is internal. Excellence of effort, not external. Achievement of result. Marcus Aurelius, the most powerful man in Rome, reminded himself constantly, "You could leave life right now. Let that determine what you do and say. And think, he ruled an empire. He still couldn't control outcomes. Wars were won and lost. Plague spread. People he loved died. The empire's fate was never fully in his hands. What he could control, his character, his response, his effort, his virtue. So that's what he focused on. That's what he perfected. That's what made him one of history's great Stoics. Not success, but character maintained, regardless of success. The project failed. Other projects will too. That's guaranteed. Anyone who tries anything worthwhile will fail repeatedly. But failure is only failure if you make outcome the measure. If you make process the measure, then every genuine effort is success. Every full engagement is victory. Every moment of doing your best, that's winning, regardless of result. This changed my relationship with risk. The old me avoided big swings because the potential failure felt like potential death. If outcome equals identity, then failure equals worthlessness. That's terrifying. That's paralyzing. The new me swings freely because I've separated my worth from the result. My identity is effort, not outcome. My peace is process, not achievement. So failure can't destroy me. It can only teach me. This is what detachment gives. Freedom to try. Freedom to fail. Freedom to learn. Freedom to engage fully without grasping desperately. I'm not indifferent. I care deeply. I try maximally. I commit fully. But I hold outcomes lightly. I release my grip on specific results. I trust that excellence of effort leads where it needs to lead, even if that's not where I thought. Seneca. Cling tooth and nail to the following rule: not to give in to adversity, not to trust prosperity, and always take full note of fortune's habit of behaving just as she pleases. Fortune is fickle, results are unreliable, outcomes are partially yours at best. So building your peace on them is building on sand. Build on stone. Build on what's actually yours. Your choices, your effort, your character, your response, that's stable. That's solid. That's something no failure can touch. The project failed. I am not my project. I am my effort. And my effort was genuine, full, excellent. That's success. That's what I keep. That's what compounds. Everything else? Just information. Just feedback. Just data for the next iteration. Detachment from outcome doesn't mean not caring about results. It means not being destroyed by results. It means maintaining your center, regardless of circumstances. It means being someone who can try, fail, learn, and try again without collapse. That person is unbreakable, not because nothing touches them, because nothing owns them. I am owned by my values, not my outcomes. Committed to my process, not my results. Measured by my effort, not my achievement. That's freedom. That's power. That's peace. The rest is just weather. Some days sunny, some days storm. Either way, I remain.